All right, so the floor is open for any issues connected to these themes. Yeah, Catherine.
Okay, so I was wondering, when you're looking into actually like promoting some sort of transformation, kind of to disrupt the social reproduction that's happening, is it more productive to focus on passive or active forms of reproduction?
So, first of all, I don't think there's some universal decontextualized answer. That's
very true.
Of course, that's the sort of So let's just think of examples. So in the women's movement, what was called consciousness raising. So consciousness raising in the women's movement was largely an effort at disrupting passive mechanisms of reproduction. Consciousness raising was not in the first instance about getting Title IX passed, winning Roe v. Wade, getting anti-discrimination laws enforced at the workplace, or even confronting a sexual harasser in the workplace. Consciousness raising groups were about people getting together and talking about their everyday life and the way in which things which they were taking for granted should be called into question. Right. So that's really an effort at disrupting the passive mechanisms. Once they are brought into effect, that may trigger their active complements to try to restore them. So thinking in these micro settings of gender, if you know, in the early 70s, late 60s, but more in the 70s in a way, when what was called consciousness-raising groups were really active in the women's movement, people would have these discussions with their friends, then they would go home and disrupt the practices that were going on in the household, and then depending upon the actual nature of the relationship in which they were, those could be slowly or quickly transformed in an uneven way, or they would meet resistance, in which more active reproduction would kick in to try to, you know, with threats, with invoking cultural norms, you know, you're not acting like a woman, etc. So there'd be more active issues once the passive ones were disrupted. There are times in which the key breakthroughs are disrupting the active mechanisms. You know, we need to change the rules of the game that are being enforced. You're unlikely to do so unless people's subjectivities have had some degree of change. But sometimes people are, for a long period of time, unhappy with existing rules of the game. They know the rules of the game are disadvantageous, but there just isn't an opening for them to mobilize against them. And then the opening occurs, and change can occur pretty rapidly. Yeah?
You talked about these universalistic norms, kind of blaming this is harm, right? And I find it kind of complicated because I think there is this is related, and it depends on objective conditions and cultural adaptations to them. For instance, we find infanticide as being harmful. Yeah?
Find what?
Infanticide when children are killed, right? But in hunter-gatherer societies, people would kill children because they can't bear kind of raising them. So they would leave one child because otherwise they would starve, and the whole tribe would starve. And for us, it's kind of unbearable. Right?
No, that's not. What you just said isn't correct. Because we would not find it, we don't find it unintelligible at all. When faced with the hard choice of the whole tribe starving or not, that infanticide becomes a practice. That's intelligible, we can understand that.
Okay.
And we would then say, under those conditions, they don't have birth control, they don't have the technologies to prevent childbirth. Under those conditions, however horrible it is in some abstract way, we can understand it. And it makes sense. And therefore, from the point of view of the harms, the social structure is not to be indicted for those harms. The low technology and the perils of being a hunter-gatherer society are. If, however, we found a society which started killing children out of pleasure, and they had plenty of food, and they just thought it was kind of cool to torture children, you know, we would say that's monstrous. And no society has ever existed. There has been no society which treats it as sport to line up children and send hungry wolves at them because it's a pleasant thing to watch, right?
Yeah, take it on the other side. I mean, if we're talking American society, people would have wonderful children, but from the point of view of an ordinary agrarian citizen, it would be kind of unbearable because there should be dozens of children. Yeah.
Again, I disagree with you. From an agrarian society, if you told them, look, let's explain it. Now, here's a society where you don't need children for insurance. You don't need, your children are all going to survive. Because agrarian societies, once mortality drops, quickly reduce fertility. For countless generations, they had maximum fertility. Within two generations, once infant mortality goes down, they reduce their fertility. Why? Because they understand. They don't need to have 10 children in order to have old age insurance to provide for them when they can no longer work. And if you explain to them, look, there's this interesting other society, and they first say, what's another society? Never heard of such a thing. And then you explain, look, the world is more complicated than you thought. Here's a society where there's lots of food, and there's a system which the government actually gives you money when you retire, when you're too old to work. And they decide to have only a couple of kids, and very rarely do they not survive. Do you think that's crazy? No, that sounds... They would understand that.
Okay, anyway, Americans have a choice. They can either raise two children and give them very high standards of living, or raise four, of course, lower standards of living, but still, they will raise four humans.
Right.
And Americans would choose kind of fewer children, but the highest standards of living for them.
Some do, some don't. There's plenty of there's plenty of families that have four or five children. Some have one, and I'm not making, when I say that the notion of harms are real, that these harms are real, they're not culturally relative. The harms that structures impose on people, at least some of them are real. Real in the sense that any person from whatever culture, if given enough information so that they could understand what the system is, would recognize that these are harms, and that it's a universe, and that this is the result of our universal human capacities for intelligence and understanding, that we are cognitively complex creatures capable of understanding the world. Those claims don't imply that there is a single standard for everything. It just means that there's a capacity for recognizing basic harms. And these examples don't contradict that. Yeah?
So then, like, would this be a case of you believing in moral truths?
It comes very close to this is a very murky and difficult issue, whether there's any objectivity to moral standards. To claim that certain moral standards are near universal, that is, all human beings have we all have a moral capacity, that's part of our evolutionary heritage, that we have the capacity for morality, and that there are some elements of that which really are cultural universals, then they get combined in different ways. They get prioritized in different ways in different cultures, but that there's some elements. That is itself just a scientific claim about human capacities. So it's not yet a philosophical claim that what is universal is in fact also objectively moral. That additional move requires other, and I think fairly murky, philosophical elements. So I'm sympathetic to that the notion that there is an objective, there are objective standards for morality, but I'm not arguing that. I'm just arguing for the near universalism. So there is no culture, for example, which says it's that doesn't have a prohibition against lying. Where cultures differ is the circumstances under which lying is justified and unjustified. But there is no human culture which is indifferent to the question, are you telling the truth or lying? They just have different rules about where the contexts, where it's okay and where it's not okay. Right? Now, that's a pretty important fact about the human, about our species. There's no culture which says it's fine to kill anybody you like. They just have different rules about where the boundaries are between a legitimate killing and an illegitimate killing, etc. But those are empirical claims about our moral capacities and our moral behavior, rather than philosophical claims that, oh, and in addition, it is wrong to kill objectively. That's a separate, requires a separate move. Yeah.
Does that imply that as one mechanism, they compensate for each other? In which case, one way to change reproduction would be to change the balance of the mechanisms?
Interesting. Yeah. No, that's an interesting point. I didn't have this sort of hydraulic, I wasn't thinking of it as quite that mechanically, but I think there's probably at least... there's a soft intuition that there are these four different kinds of mechanisms which stabilize the social order. In some contexts, there's a lot of work that ideology has to do because the order would be very fragile without it. In other contexts, the social order is working quite well with respect to these other processes. So ideology is still always present, but it's less demanding. So I guess that... it's not necessarily strictly zero sum. There may be redundancy too. But there is a certain sense, there's at least some kind of implication about there being alternative configurations that will accomplish the same level of stability, depending upon where the imperfections or obstacles or contradictions are most concentrated. Yeah?
This, it's kind of the same question, but a little more detailed. It seems that the last few decades, well, first, if we say that social reproduction, that its purpose, overall purpose, is to maintain ideology and class structure, over the last few decades, we've been maintaining ideology, at least in America, but our class structure has been shifting a lot. So you would think that would increase, since there's not being affirmations, and you know that interests aren't being, people are doing. They're doing what they're supposed to do, but the rewards aren't occurring. You would think that the active social reproduction would have to increase somehow, you know, through fighting crime or something, but the only real cost that's increased over the last few decades has been media. We haven't increased education or fighting crime or anything like that. We're maintaining ideology only.
Sam?
I mean, the war on drugs happened. I mean, police violence is up. There was, what was this book called? It came out like 3 years ago. They did some detailed studies that like SWAT teams have quadrupled in number over the course of the past 15 or 20 years.
So
there were a bunch of cases in Kansas and Florida where they were just sending SWAT teams on raids weekly just to justify
right.
their existence.
So let me first comment on the first part of what you said, and then I'll comment on the use of coercion. The American class structure, in terms of its foundations, has not really changed. That is, it's no less capitalist than it was before. There's changes in the class structure, but not... social reproduction is... The problem for social reproduction is to stabilize and reproduce the capitalist character of the class structure. And if anything, the capitalist character of the class structure has been strengthened by the rhythms of capitalism over the last decades, not weakened at all. So the it is not the case that there are any challenges to the capitalist character of the class structure that would pose special problems to social reproduction. That's the first point. A second point is, it's true that insecurity has increased for most people, for a substantial proportion of the population. It's actually not true that insecurity has probably increased for most people, that is more than 50%. It's just increased the percentage of the population who no longer feel confident they can predict what their economic situation will be 10 years from now, that feel uncertain about their own future. That percentage has increased. But it is still the case that the majority of people in the United States have asked the question, do you think 10 years from now, how likely do you think it is that you will be poor, at about the same level that you are now, or a little bit better? You know, you ask them just to make a predict. The majority of people predict they'll be about the same as they are now or a little bit better. And it's just that the percentage who say they really don't know, they feel very uncertain, that's increased. And all of this is occurring at a historically very high baseline standard of living. Even, you know, until you get to the bottom 20% or so of the income distribution, people are still at the, if you're at the 30th percentile, you are in absolute material terms living better than the average, than the median person was 70 years ago, 60 years, than in your grandparents' generation. So in terms of this question, is capitalism satisfying some basic material interests of large numbers of people? It is still doing so, but under more demanding and less secure conditions than in the past. So that material interests part of the equation hasn't collapsed. It's also the case, and this is something that's difficult to really get your head around fully, I mean, to really understand its implications. If you distinguish between individual earnings and household income, what we've observed in the last 3 or 4 decades is stagnation in median earnings. It's gone up a little bit, but it's pretty stagnant of median earnings. But this has gone along with two other facts. Average household size has gone down. Fertility rates have gone down. So people have fewer children. And labor supply by households has gone way up. So the median household income per capita. So if you think of it as not per household, but per capita in the household, that's gone up, hasn't been stagnant. So when people ask themselves, am I living better in terms of what I'm consuming, just in ordinary bullshit consumerist terms, than 30 years ago, or than my parents were 30 years ago, for the majority of the population, the answer is yes, even though we've been in an era of stagnation. Right, so there's this disconnect between the biographical trajectory of individuals, which has been modest improvement, and these correct statistics that we are in a period where the gap between the rich and the poor have gone up, between the rich and the median have gone up, where the insecurity has gone up. So it's a complicated picture. Overall, though, I think capitalism remains hegemonic in the sense that it relies, developed capitalism relies primarily on the ways in which it's actually incorporating enough material interests of enough people for that to be the kind of stabilizing core. That's reinforced by ideologies, neoliberalism and other things that say this is the only possibility, there is no other. And then coercion and rules buttress that whole operation. On the specific coercion thing, I don't think the use of police in these brutal ways and the massive increase in incarceration that we've observed should be primarily thought of as the necessary coercion to reproduce capitalism. That is, capitalism as such doesn't require this level of coercive repression. This is what's needed for a particular kind of capitalism. That is, a capitalism with the kinds of inequalities that U.S. capitalism, in contrast to European capitalism. So this is the result of a particular you have to move to a lower level of abstraction. It's a particular kind of capitalism with a particular kind of ruling class, with a particular kind of coalitional structure and history. You know, we can explain this, but I don't think the level of coercion should be thought of as the functional condition necessary for the reproduction of capitalism as such. And then, Lauren.
So American capitalism is hegemonic interests and ideology are primarily responsible for reproduction. Do you have a gut feeling about which of those two carries most of the burden, ideology or interests? Or is there any way you can really answer that more precisely?
I mean, my general instinct in general is to put an emphasis on the interest side of the equation, that if that really is crumbling, then the ideological stuff runs into trouble. And that's kind of my... And that the ideological side serves mostly to obstruct efforts at building alternatives. So it's more difficult than it would otherwise be to build even a social democratic party that would pose a challenge to the kind of capitalism we have. That is, the kind of capitalism we have with its inequalities and its insecurities, even though it does accommodate people's interests in a modest, if imperfect, way, would be vulnerable to more left populism of a social democratic character if it wasn't for the hyper-individualist ideological framework with which the state is discredited and other things occur. In the specific American case, I think the institutional rules for democratic politics play a very big role in blocking the development of alternative ideology. So the particular rules we have for elections, which are among the worst in the developed liberal capitalist world, the worst from the point of view of democratic values. These particular rules of electoral competition block the possibility of having tractable progressive parties, which then also would open the space for, at this lower level of abstraction, for a different kind of capitalism to develop in the U.S. So I think for some problems, the institutional rules would loom as the key issue. For others, ideology. And both rules and ideology I would give more weight to than sheer coercion, which I think, it's not that it plays no role, it certainly does play a role, but I don't think it's the central explanation for why the U.S. is in its current situation. I'll get back to you tomorrow.
I'm going to change the topic a little bit.
Okay, so if this is right on this topic.
Yeah, right.
Okay. Yeah.
It's about material interests. I mean, I share the values of socialist economy, but I'm trying to be a devil's advocate. As you said before, people got a fair or better than 30 years ago, right? And on page 200, you write that within a well-functioning capitalism, the material interests of nearly everyone depend in a significant degree upon successful capitalist economic activity. So the question arises, why should we change anything if it's so efficient? Well, I would kind of say that there are cycles and capitalism has worse when it's in crisis. But anyway, any economy is crisis. There are kind of cycles of crisis for thousands of years. So will we reduce, substitute the capitalist economy with a better one? Isn't it the most efficient, let's say, if we kind of have objective figures?
Well, the belief that there is no alternative to capitalism is crucial for why people buy into capitalism being, quote, the most efficient. The question you're asking has too many different elements in it, and for the present context. It is simply not true that capitalism is an efficient system. That's an illusion. It's not efficient. It's massively inefficient in all sorts of ways, which are denied by defenders of capitalism. the ways in which it's inefficient are not registered in the market. They're registered in the way people's lives are harmed in all sorts of ways by capitalism. So if efficiency means how much human well-being is being generated by our collective activity to produce the goods and services that people consume, if that's our efficiency criteria, given how much effort we're putting into it, how much well-being is being generated, capitalism is a grossly inefficient system. It's not grossly inefficient compared to an authoritarian, central planned, corrupt command and control economy. There are things worse than capitalism. And if the only comparison that's allowed is between the United States and the Soviet Union, let's say, or between contemporary China and the China of, you know, of Mao or the Cultural Revolution, or the Great Leap Forward, perhaps even more, if those are the only allowed comparisons, then capitalism comes off pretty well. The relevant comparison, however, is not between capitalism and the worst form of alternative we can come up with, but capitalism and a more democratic and egalitarian alternative. The problem with that comparison is that it doesn't exist. Right? So it's a comparison based on theoretical arguments about what kind of effects would occur if we had the democratic capacity to evaluate the consequences of our cooperative activity for things like the environment, for health, for the enjoyment of life, for the meaningfulness of people's activity in work and so on. So the relevant comparison for the indictment of capitalism is a much tougher task. This is part of the ideological support for capitalism. As when we get to the ideology section, I will argue that there are three key questions that ideologies answer. What exists, what is good, and what is possible. Ideologies answer those questions for you. What exists, or the order is probably what is good, what exists, and what is possible. And the ideology that's dominant in capitalist society has answers for all of those questions. The claim that capitalism is not the optimal way for people to live depends upon arguments against the conventional answers to those three questions. That's very tough to do. You know, that's part of the system of social reproduction, is that the ideological belief there is no alternative, which means either there's no good alternative, what is good, or there is no possible alternative. You know, that's the what is possible. Those are hard ideas to defeat. That's what the social democratic and socialist agenda is all about, is defeating, as an ideological project, is defeating and transforming and challenging those elements of the system of social reproduction. Now, in terms of why is capitalism so stable, that is, it's pretty stable once it's developed beyond a certain point, stable against challenge. One set of mechanisms are these ideological ones, but it's also the fact that most people's lives are materially tolerable under capitalism. So what's being asked of people is, do you want something that would be better than something that's tolerable, as opposed to better than something which is intolerable? So when Marx says, "Workers of the world unite, you have nothing to lose but your chains and a world to win," that "you have nothing to lose but your chains" is a ideologically unpersuasive move in contemporary conditions. That's the interests mechanism of social reproduction at work. The fact that you can't really go to a worker at Epic Software in Verona on their campus. They work very hard, they get paid modestly, but pretty well, and you can't say, "Look, you have nothing to lose but your chains." I mean, it just doesn't make sense that they have nothing to lose but their chains. They have lots of things to lose besides their chains. Now, they may also be better off in a world that's more democratic and egalitarian, and their children will be even better off. You know, there's all these kinds of arguments. The world might cook at a slower rate. You know, there's all sorts of good arguments. But the interest mechanism that makes capitalism stable and thus hegemonic, I mean, that's the hegemonic aspect, is that it does satisfy enough of the interests of the subordinated population as to raise the stakes and costs of an effort at transformation. Now, mostly, you know, this I'm giving more answer to this than is probably needed right at the moment. Mostly what this really says is that the Big Bang theory of transformation is really not historically relevant at the moment. Big Bang meaning we can imagine a rupture. This gets to the fourth of my elements, logics of strategy. That is the ruptural vision that we can posit in advance an alternative that is so attractive that people are prepared to mobilize collectively to destroy the present institutional configuration that supports the existing economic structure and move rapidly to a system-level alternative. That's the ruptural vision. Ruptural visions, I think, simply have no plausibility under conditions where the existing system has these hegemonic mechanisms of reproduction. It just has no plausibility. Even if it is imaginable, it'll never be implementable. And I'm not sure that it's just a question of implementation. I think it's also, there's other problems in it. Therefore, we need these other kinds of strategies, which I refer to as metamorphosis strategies, where you imagine ways in which you can transform the existing structure of dominations and inequalities, not by a ruptural break with the existing institutions, but by building the alternatives which are corrosive of the existing order, and which then change it over time in a more complex way. That doesn't fit slogans as well. It's not as inspiring with respect to classical, you know, revolutionary ideologies. But it may in fact be the necessary form of transformation if actually we're going to move in the right direction. Tomorrow.
So a couple of comments and questions about this chart, about the strategies for transformation, especially about the column about the pivotal collective actors that you identify for each of the categories.
Mm-hmm.
So one question. So how generalizable do you think this chart is in time and space, or do you think of it more relevant for the U.S. and Europe? And I ask this because at the beginning of, like, 20th century Latin American historical examples where, like, perhaps political parties lend more of themselves to, in some cases, like, some sort of symbiotic metamorphosis, or I can think of, like, social movements that have a more ruptural vision, and then maybe eventually form a party, I don't know, like, a more complex kind of scenario in that sense. And then another question following up on that, if you had to do another column, identifying the role and justification of violence and perhaps guerrilla warfare, things like that, in each of the categories, what would you say?
So one thing which I would really encourage all of you who are interested in these things at this level of abstraction to do is to just treat this chart as a point of departure and build your own charts. You know, treat this as an analytical exercise. So this is almost paradigmatic for how I approach problems, right? I try to make distinctions and clarify the dimensionalities of the distinctions. Right? So this is one effort of doing so. If it may be time and space bound, in which case you might want to say this is the 21st century global north model, let's look at the others. But you might then discover that actually there's not as much difference as one thinks. When the words might be a little different. So are social movements ever capable of ruptural transformation? Is that even remotely possible? Unless they become organized as political parties. And once they become organized as political parties, are they really still social movements, or is it really what they've actually become are classes organized as social parties? So it would be the class might be a broader kind of class coalition than the kind of classical European model of a labor party or a workers' party. It might be a workers' and peasants' party. It might be a party of the exploited. You know, there might be different ways of thinking about it. But is a true ruptural strategy possible if they remain just in the usual sense social movements? So I was, when I say the pivotal collective actors for transformation, when I said classes organized as political parties, that's because the theory of ruptural transformation, of that possibility, the only theory that's been proposed is the Marxian theory. No other social theories imagine the possibility of ruptural transformation. And within Marxism, the key collective actors are classes organized as parties, as revolutionary parties. That if classes fail to organize as parties, they can't rupture. If the parties are not classes, but are some other kind of, they won't produce a rupture. It's only if the political parties that are organized and capable of providing coherence are themselves connected to popular classes that they might have that potential. As for violence, violence most obviously fits into the ruptural logic because the metaphor of conflict is warfare. Warfare is violence. You know, so it's primarily, it understands transformation in terms of victories and defeats. Whether one can imagine, whether it's reasonable to say there are contexts in which certain kinds of violence are needed in order to create the space for interstitial activity. So if interstitial activity requires protected spaces, enclaves, where you can actually build alternatives, and those are under continual pressure and attack, well, you may need, violence may be necessary part of the defense or extension of those spaces. And the same could be true for the symbiotic metamorphosis, too. If the problem-solving capacities that symbiotic transformations are transformations which involve collaboration with elites rather than just ignoring them. They do involve collaboration with elites to solve problems which the elites see as problems, but you solve the problems in a way that advantages popular forces. That's what the symbiotic idea is. Symbiotic metamorphosis may not be possible in a context where the state is extremely authoritarian. And so it might be that violent resistance to the state is needed in order to change the particular form of the state in order to create the possibility for symbiotic. So things like the Arab Spring, which were not ruptural transformations. They did not propose changing the fundamental structures of the system, the social system. They were political ruptures, not social ruptures. They're strictly political ruptures. So it's possible under some circumstances a political rupture is needed in order to unleash the possibility of symbiotic transformation. Now I'm speaking super abstractly here using this jargon, but and so it might be that violence is needed to create the space within which either the interstitial could occur or in which the symbiotic could occur. That's a different notion of rupture, though, than saying that actually what our goal is a rupture in the system itself. That the system as a whole cannot be ruptured. It can only evolve or ecologically transform, you know, the two combination of interstitial and symbiotic. You can't rupture the system. It just won't work, would be the claim that I'm making in this context. And so violence, then, would play very specific potential roles with respect to different contexts. Yeah?
I just got a question about the passive reproduction and the past dependency. I mean, somehow I feel, I don't know if it's true that we can say that the passive reproduction is more past dependent. Like, take the example of Tibetans. Like, they have this kind of culture centered on religious institution that is reincarnation. So they naturally, very very much not materialistic and environmentalist, but also because of their pretty like passive and bounded by this institution, it is kind of hard for them to like simply move to this kind of like modern liberal society, because they kind of believe in this reincarnation. So I don't know if it's true to say that this kind of passive reproduction by the religion or institution is much more past dependent.
Okay, so let me just explain very quickly the notion of path dependency. This is familiar, I'm sure, to many of you, but not all of you. So the idea of path dependency is that things which happened in the past, there were certain moments where institutions were created, often deliberately at that moment, but then they set in in line a subsequent development that's hard to get out of. That once you're on a particular path, it's hard to exit it. So there are certain historical moments that are crucial for creating institutional configurations that set in train a path that follows in the future. Two examples that are familiar in this discussion. One simple one, this happens in technologies all the time. The layout of the English language keyboard on typewriters, Q-W-E-R-T-Y, was designed so that typewriter salesmen could put their fingers on the keys and type the word typewriter without moving their fingers. That is, you can type the word typewriter without ever having to reposition your hand. And that's so that people who couldn't type could demonstrate in the early typewriter how to type it. It was also designed to be a not efficient way of typing, because if you typed in a more efficient way, the keys jammed. Because the early typewriters were mechanical, and you needed to type slowly enough so that the keys wouldn't hit each other, right? So the combination of that gives you Q-W-E-R-T-Y, which is not the best way to lay out a typewriter, now especially with computers. There are other layouts. The problem is that so many people know how to type on a QWERTY typewriter keyboard that if you do the more rational one called Dvorak keyboard, which can give you, if you learn from scratch on it, can increase your typing speed as a touch typist by about 40 or 50%. I mean, it's a big increase in speed. It's just too hard for anybody once they've learned one to switch to the other. The transition costs are huge. The rate of typographical errors are so big as to just not be worth the investment of time, even though once you're done with the transition, you'd be much more efficient, right? So that's technological path dependency. Another kind of path dependency is things like you have a revolution, you set up the rules of the game for your electoral competition, you decide at that moment, is it going to be proportional representation or first past the post single member districts? At the moment that those are established, nobody has in mind particular consequences. It's not that they're asking, in the 21st century, are we going to have the possibility of an ideological stalemate as opposed to more flexible, pragmatic? You know, nobody's thinking about the long term. These are practical decisions that are made. And often it's kind of arbitrary. Sometimes big decisions get made for no good reason because nobody has any particular theory about what's the consequences of one or another. Or they're just mechanically following some previous pre-democratic form that kind of looked like this. Well, clearly the way the electoral rules get set up matters a lot, as we know, for what kind of parties you end up with. So that's path dependency. Now, the question of whether there's cultural path dependency is also important. That is, if you have a religion that has certain kinds of belief systems and it's well established in some ancient period, and generation after generation, it gets taught to the children, and it's part of just people's common understanding. And then you find yourself in a different kind of world from the one in which that was started, in which you acquired that. How constraining is that religious heritage? How much does it block your ability to create new institutions and find new solutions and to adapt to the world in new ways given that the previous quasi-feudal, you know, the Tibetan Buddhist tradition occurred in a very repressive socioeconomic structure. It's not nowhere, not as the Dalai Lama is an extremely compelling, compassionate, actually very radical person in terms of his political economic views. He's basically declared himself a communist, small c communist, in terms of his views about how the means of production and the economy should be organized. It should be done in a communal and collective way for the benefit of all. But he's part of a religious heritage that goes back to a very exploitative and repressive feudal order. Well, how constraining is the religious ideology? My feeling is, by itself, it's not very constraining. That the underlying values and ethoses of different religious traditions are very adaptable to new contexts. That it becomes constraining when it's also connected to power structures and social structures, not in and of itself. That the pure textual content, discursive content of the ideas, are not robust in the face of demands of practical life. There'll be some people who will remain wedded to very narrow, rigid interpretations, and many others who become much more flexible. And you see that in, you know, in Islam, when the third generation of Islamic immigrants from very traditional cultures are in developed European and North American settings, where they are able to be fully integrated into the social structure, the kind of rigid gender roles and the like, which their parents' generation and grandparents' generation took for granted, they don't take for granted anymore. You know, it's not the way human subjectivities are formed. If they are in an enclave that's isolated and rigidly disciplined, and then the exclusionary practices of a larger society push them back on themselves to find social support, that's a different story. Of course, that's religion is serving a different purpose. It's not just as a guide to moral action, it's a way of preserving community and protecting yourself from the ravages of a broader society. All right, we're past our 12 o'clock. Next time, okay, just to tell you where we're going now, we're done with the grand introduction. Now we are hitting the first focused, substantive topic, the nature of classes, class structures in capitalist society, and how to understand the problem of class. Hardcore sociology is afoot.